This is Fairbanks Arts Review, and I'm Robert Gilfillan. Tonight we'll hear about style and writing from Barry Lopez, and of course we'll sample A Movable Feast, so stay tuned.
I awoke one night and thought I heard rain. It was the dry needles of fir trees falling on the roof. Men with an intolerable air of condolence have appeared, as though drawn by the smell of death, dressed comfortably, speaking a manipulated tongue, terminally evil. They have inquired into the purchase of our homes, and reporters come and go, outraged over the absence of brown trout, which have never been here. The river, like some great whale, lies dying in the forest. In the years we have been here, I have trained myself to listen to the river, not in the belief that I could understand what it said, but only from one day to the next know its fate. The river's language arose principally from two facts. The slightest change in its depth brought it into contact with a different portion of the stones along its edges and the rocks and boulders midstream that lay in its way, and so changed its tone. And although its movement around one object may seem uniform at any one time, it is in fact changeable. Added to these major variations are the landings of innumerable insects on its surface, the breaking of its waters by fish, the falling into it of leaves and twigs, the slushing of raccoons, the footfalls of deer. Ultimately, these are only commentary on the river's endless reading of the surface of the earth over which it flows.
Barry Holston Lopez reading from his book River Notes, accompanied by David Darling on the cello. Lopez was in town this weekend to introduce a new choral work by composer John Adams and poet John Haynes, and I had an opportunity to talk with Lopez. He's probably best known for his book Of Wolves and Men, which is an examination of the wolf in science, myth, and popular culture. His latest work, Winter Count, is a collection of short stories, and in both fiction and nonfiction, Lopez's style is sparse and lucid, with a poetic sense of rhythm. I began our discussion by asking Lopez if his style came naturally to him.
I think that comments about style are usually, writers are put in the awkward position of having to describe what they do in terms of what critics say. And often, someone said that critics are, they don't know how to drive, but they have the map, you know. And so they're always giving directions and always categorizing writers and putting people in different boxes, particularly in universities, and they're saying these people all belong together and this person is like this person, and this is the school of this, and new modernism, and all the rest of it. I think that if your approach to your work is genuine, that the style is something you can't do anything about. It's the way in which you come to express yourself. That's one part of it. Another part of style, I think, is the effort you make to make yourself clear. There is a handful of things you're trying to do as a writer. You're trying to achieve clarity. You're trying to organize what is chaotic into some sort of order. You're trying as well as you can for an elegant or uplifting or powerful kind of language. And all of that is the result of honing and taking out what is unnecessary and editing yourself and all of those things over a period of time bring you to a style that is innately your own, and you hope it makes what you're thinking about or what you're writing about easily accessible to a broad range of minds. There's a problem in universities with sometimes a confusion between writing and communication. And a lot of people have the ability to put words on paper, but no one knows what in God's name they're saying. It's so turgid and so impenetrable that it makes a reader work and work and work to try to find out what this person meant. And I think that sometimes there is a conceit on the part of people who are
very intelligent to think that the reader has an obligation to plow through all of this turgid prose in order to discover the brilliance of the author's thought. I think that's rubbish, and I think most people who read think the same thing. The reader has no obligation to work to get through a piece. I mean, there are pieces that are operating at such a level that you have to really be paying attention when you read. But the writer has an obligation to be clear and to make, in the highest sense, to make the work entertaining. And what you had said earlier about there not being a great deal of difference in some ways between my work that is fiction or a short story and the work that I do, an essay or a nonfiction book or something like that, I'm trying to do the same thing all the time. It's just a matter of working with different kinds of resources. In a work of fiction, you're working, or I am, largely with memories and perceptions that go back over my whole life. And in nonfiction, I'm much more conscious of what is conventional research, that is work in the library and interviews and traveling and talking to people and making observations and keeping notebooks and whatnot. I think those two kinds of writing are very different. They have different physiological effect. You know, people hardly ever talk about what a physical act writing is. But it is. If you write well, you're exhausted at the end of a period of work. I mean, you're physically drained. But it's a different kind of draining, I think, when you're talking about one and the other. Working on a piece of fiction drains you in a different way than does working on a piece of nonfiction.
Well, do you think that the categories then that critics put on artists are valid? Are they handy? Are they tools? Or do they really pretty much get in the way of someone enjoying a...
I think that they are handy. I think that's a good way to talk about it. You're dealing with a range of material so that you have to get some kind of taxonomy going. You have to divide things up in some way. I think, obviously, people... The less going on in the mind, the more dogmatic the mind becomes, you know. So you get people who really don't know what's going on, but they live to categorize and to hair split and things like that. Well, these are not really very interesting, ultimately very interesting questions. I think if you're trying to impress someone or you really don't know who you are or you're trying to find your way or something, then you might take an objective approach to trying to establish a style or work in one form or another. I don't mean to be disrespectful of the distinctions between the forms. I, in my own mind, have a very clear set of obligations that I follow when I'm working in one form or another. But I am a writer, I'm not a critic, and so I don't spend very much time trying to decide what is which and which is what. It's not really very much interest to me. On the other hand, I would say very quickly that often a writer can discover something about what he or she is doing by listening to a critic, because the critic brings a mental apparatus to a story that is not at all what a writer brings to a story. I remember when I was in school, you know, when I was young, and I thought, like all of us do, that, you know, why isn't the writer here in the room with us? He'd be able to tell us what this story really means. Well, you get older and you realize that even if the writer were there, the writer might not be able to tell you what the story meant. And I, from my point of view, the story is a creature. The story is something that is alive. And when I think of nonfiction or an essay or a short story, all of those forms are stories to me, and they're all alive. And what you're trying to do as a writer is to get that, almost like an animal that is inside of you, out onto a piece of paper. And in the first draft, in the moments after a first draft, you feel a state of exhaustion and a state of elation and pleasure because the animal is out. But what you have to do, or what I have to do at least, is walk away, because I cannot at that moment, and I don't think any writer really can, determine what part of the beast is still inside you and what part is on the paper. And the process of rewriting is going back and realizing, aha, this part that I thought was actually on the piece of paper in language is not. It's still inside me. So you rewrite to bring the animal out completely. And then you reach a point where you're finished rewriting and you release the story. That is, you say, I'm sort of thinking about this for the first time, but you send it off to a magazine or something like that, but you let it go. And then it is truly something all on its own, and in some ways it remains as mysterious to you as it is to a reader. And in that sense, a good critic can come along and say, for example, I read a story you wrote 10 years ago, and I read this story, and I see you're still working with these same ideas, and you say to yourself, huh, you know, I am, and I feel good about that. I think that most writers spend their lives dealing with a handful of questions in different forms, but you're dealing with the same few questions all the time. And a critic can make that clear to you. And I think that I often, when I think of stories, I think of a story, for example, as a medicine bundle. There is a tradition which I'm grossly generalize about among Plains Indians in which men and women both had dreams, and the dreams were induced in the sense that you entered a state of elevated attention and dehydration and did not eat. So you shut certain parts of the body down and focused the body's energy in other places. You went to a place that was very powerful, and you dreamed. And out of that dream came some kind of guiding vision for your life. And when you returned to your home, to your village or whatever it was, you took the components of the dream and that were major components, a bird or a kind of soil or rock or something like that, a plant, and you gathered those components in the landscape and you ceremonially put them together in a bundle. And the bundle was a dream bundle. And that's what I think of. Often I think of stories in terms of these dream bundles or medicine bundles. And I do believe that. I believe literature can heal. I believe in that fundamentally. And that if the dream is dreamed well, and it also I like this idea because it makes clear that the story is not something you own, something you made up. There is something that comes through you, and that passes through you and becomes the story then can become of benefit to the community. You certainly give it order and you bring your art to it, but it's not completely your own. That's a conceit that, in my view, that some people have, that they do it all by themselves. But when I think of story, I also think of stories as ecosystems, in the sense that when you walk out, say, outside of Fairbanks here somewhere in the interior of Alaska, or you go on the Brooks Range, or you go into the Everglades or something like that, you see certain colors you see nowhere else. Not single colors, but the combination, the way the colors fall together, the line of the landscape against the sky, the kinds, the numbers, the proportions of the animals, the temperatures, the time it takes a weather system to move through. If you live in the interior of Alaska, you're not intimate with the wind, because the wind doesn't play a very strong role here. And as soon as you look at the trees, you can see the wind is not playing a strong role. Although you can tell, because the trees don't get very tall, something about the temperature regimes here. So when you're looking out in what we think of as an ecosystem or a biome, you're aware of certain obvious relationships in the landscape. Say the predator-prey relationship of wolves and moose, for example. Other relationships are so subtle, so esoteric, so rarefied, we don't even have the language to elucidate them. But we know they're there, and we have a sense, an unarticulated sense of appreciation. I think exactly the same thing goes on in a story. You can sit down in a critical framework and say, the story, these are the characters, this is the plot, this is something about, say, the author's idiosyncratic use of rhythm in sentence. Certain relationships are discernible, but there are other things in the story that are completely a mystery. And in that sense, the story is like an ecosystem. And a good story is something you can go back to again and again, as you can go back to the Brooks Range again and again. And each time you go back, you discover something new. And obviously we're not talking about every kind of piece of writing, you know, but the great novels. You know, Moby Dick was a formative book for me, and I think between the ages of 13 or 14 when I first read it and probably 19 or 20 years old, I must have read the book 6 times. And each time, because I had grown a little older, I understood a set of relationships that went right by me the first time. And of course, the same is true of a person. A human being is an ecosystem. Obviously, certain parts of the human being are visible, I to you, you to me. But my word, there's a whole history of memory and passion in you that I don't know anything about. And it is part of what is that ecosystem that is you. We get to know each other over a period of time. We become friends, and I become more and more fascinated with the wilderness that is my friend or something like that. And I think also here is this element which I feel very strongly about in terms of how you relate to a landscape, and that you should always establish an atmosphere of dignity and respect, of mutual regard. You should do that with people. You should do that with stories. You do that in all the arts. I think that, when you go into a theater and you see this proscenium arch and the curtain is drawn, I think the human heart allows that this curtain is going to come back, and no matter how amateur the performers or the playwright or whatever it is, the heart is fully there. And then as the play goes on, it might not be fully there because it's not a good performance or something like that. But in the moment of first confrontation, the atmosphere is one of regard rather than cynicism, respect rather than condescension. And that, in my views, in the times I've been in the field with wildlife biologists, with wolves and mountain lions and polar bear and muskoxen and narwhal, walrus, every animal that I've been fortunate enough to be with, I find that in the scientific mind as well as in the mind of the humanist, if you wish, if you approach the animal as though it were fundamentally a mystery and say, I have a fundamental regard for the animal, I realize that no matter how elegant and complex the series of questions is that is brought up to describe the animal will never be the sum of the answers to questions. It will always be a step beyond our comprehension. So it makes sense to say, well, always a good way to start out to have this atmosphere of dignity and respect and regard for the mystery. Approach people the same way, and as far as I'm concerned, approach literature the same way. And that makes, to me, the obligation of the writer. If you're going to ask for the reader's time, then you have an obligation to work as well as you can within your flaws to bring a story to bear so that a reader could put it down and say, well, this was okay, but it really didn't speak to me. And another reader can say, I really understood something about myself. I became more coherent within myself because I read this story. I believe that in this, this idea of the story as being, the reading of a story being a healing experience, going through here with, or at least trying to think, I'm not entirely off the top of my head, but maybe I'm not as organized as I wish I would be, but if a story is a recapitulation in one way or another of an ecosystem of one type or another, when you go into a landscape that is unmanaged, that is part of, that its primal energy, it's the energy that derives from its evolution, its arrangement in time, comes to you, you feel an exhilaration. You feel cleaned out. You feel that the things that matter not at all have been stripped away from your conscious mind, and you're not buried in the bottom of all of the concerns we have on a day-to-day basis about paying the bills and your family and all these other things that are part of our day-to-day living. I think the same thing happens with a story. A story has a kind of coherence in it, a good story, so that if you expose yourself to it, what is chaotic inside of you becomes more organized, becomes more coherent, simply by virtue of being exposed to the story. Same thing, I think, happens when you listen to a symphony. I mean, my God, you can walk out of a concert hall having heard a symphony, and you're not articulate about it often enough, but your capacity for love, your movement, the feelings you have of compassion and of goodwill. Even if it's a dark piece, I think, even if it's a dark piece, the sense of the ability, the relocated, the refound, the rediscovered ability to live a full life, having come in contact with a powerful work of art, is an unmistakable thing.
You put me in the mind of a great many things, but let me go back and just talk for a minute about labels, just to introduce this next question, because I noticed in your discussion there were several metaphors that you used to describe writing and everything related to it. For example, the natural world. That, in fact, the natural world was one of the metaphors you applied. Another one was the animal. And one of the labels that a reviewer put on you was a wilderness writer. I'm not sure what that is.
Me either.
Oh, I was going to ask you what that meant to you and whether you thought that...
Well, I think Dostoevsky's a wilderness writer.
Of the soul.
Yes.
But this relationship, this awe, this feeling of respect that one should bring to an art or even to the world or human relations isn't one that's very common in our society as a whole. I mean, I think in historical and sociological terms, we go much more with a sort of competition edge, that Greek idea of competing, of being better, like the idea of Odysseus, being better than most men, but clever and a contentious sort of person who tries to grapple nature and fellow men, not in sinister terms, but grapple and overcome in some way. Now, do you think that this element of respect is something that we can that a work of art fosters? I think Anthony Burgess said that every great work of art makes a person better.
Yes.
In some way. And do you think that's really possible?
I do think that it's possible to expose yourself to a certain kind of work, to dance, to theater, to painting, to sculpture, to writing, and come away better for it. And I do think that in that sense the arts are therapeutic. It is also possible, obviously, to live a narrow and mean-spirited life, and many people choose to do that. In the same way that a metal is annealed and comes to take a peculiar but strong shape, I think some people take that shape somewhere in their 20s or whatever it is, and they never escape from a condition of suspicion and mean-spirited approach to other human beings and to the world. Often, I think it's because people are wounded. I don't think we say publicly often enough that this business of being a human being is tremendously difficult, tremendously difficult. Most of us, even in this terrible world that we live in where everyone is exposing their private lives in magazines and things like that, I think we still live in essentially a very private world. And many of us have been deeply wounded. We have fallen in love and not had it reciprocated. We have lost someone that we cared for, a parent or something like that, at what was for us selfishly just absolutely the wrong moment to lose somebody like that. We have lost animals, or we have experienced public humiliation. We have sought to do well in an arena where we've been made fool of. We have made public mistakes. We have found all of that crushing embarrassment of adolescence played out in our adult lives in different ways. Every one of us has suffered like this. I mean, you can walk down the street anywhere. You can walk down the street in Fairbanks or any other town and stop a person on the street and hear a story that would break your heart, if the person could tell the story well enough. And when you realize that, I think it brings up in you a sense of compassion for the difficulty that all of us have, instead of that wasteful state of mind in which we're always critical of this person or that person or the other person, this politician or the other, you know, this meretricious, that and the other thing. And I think what you have to do in your life is to, if you allow yourself to be burdened by the worst expressions of human existence, whether it's a melee or a presidential election or whatever it happens to be that depresses you, then you become the tool and the victim of those events, rather than, say, the adult mind recognizes, I think this is a quality of the adult mind as opposed to the mind that is still maturing. The adult mind recognizes fully that life is moments of beauty and moments of horror, true horror. Not this silly business of that you see in the movies, you know, with the horror films. That isn't horror. That is not what horror is. But the recognition of horror and beauty simultaneously in the world is the recognition of paradox, is the recognition of irony, is the recognition of counterpoint, is the recognition of contradiction. And to recognize that you can't have, you know, a life of ethereal moments, one right after the other, that life really is this confrontation of beauty and horror, and that what your obligation to do as an adult is to find a way to live with grace in the middle of it, then...
Grace under pressure.
Yes, and the pressure is always there. And where you get the source of grace is your friendship with other people, your support within your family, and I think to a great extent the kinds of art that you expose yourself to.
Well, you know, it seems to me that much of that mean-spirited quality that is so prevalent in our society, so easy to fall into,
yes,
is to some degree a result of narrowed vision.
I would say not only the result of narrowed vision. Do you want to say more? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to draw in again this question of wilderness. It seems to me that one of the amazing elements about confronting nature, whatever aspect of nature it is, human nature or the physical nature, is the fact that suddenly you're brought into perspective.
Yes.
That in one point you see a process taking place that you're a part of that continues without you, and yet somehow you're in an integral part of that. And it seems to me in your work, this comes across very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just come across a wilderness rider. I don't know what that is either. You know, it's sort of like you go out and...
Well, one of the things I would say about wilderness writing or natural history writing is that, you know, people who write about animals and write about landscape, this is one of the distinguishing characteristics of what is truly American literature. I think if you look at a story like... I spoke about Moby Dick early on, and Stephen Crane's The Open Boat, or The Blue Hotel, or you can go back into the 19th century and come all the way through the 20th century, obviously, and find people writing about the human relationship, the relationship of men and women to landscape and their involvement with animals. This is a good example of one of those things that you just can't bother to spend very much time arguing with critics about. If critics want to say that people like myself and or say an Annie Dillard or Peter Matheson or anyone who uses the metaphors of natural history in order to explore the problems that we face as human beings, that you're a nature writer or a wilderness writer, well, that's what they want to say. That's what they're talking about. It's certainly not a way in which I think about myself. You know, I'm not a biologist. I wouldn't even describe myself as a naturalist. I have an abiding human interest in a certain few questions about the nature and structure of prejudice is one, probably. The notion of tolerance, what tolerance is another question that's very important to me. How we as adults in our culture approach other cultures, the culture of the polar bear, the culture of Lakota people, the culture of San people in the Kalahari Desert, the culture that from which we derive, the Cro-Magnon culture of Europe. I would like as a writer to find ways to bring an audience into those arenas and show them that, or create a situation in which a reader could feel utterly at ease, completely fascinated, mesmerized, touch a bit of the mystery of that, and depart and not feel intimidated or that what they were doing was the worst or anything else, but to participate completely as possible in what is different and walk away from it without feeling that a comparison had to be made or that one was right and one was wrong.
You brought up mystery, and that's an element, I don't know, it's not a subject matter maybe when you talk about these arenas,
mm-hmm,
but certainly one of the things that pervades your work is this sort of respect for mystery, and it comes across very clearly. It's not... You know, you sometimes have the idea that in certain people who deal with the natural order of things, they're either scientists who elucidate either well or not so well the mechanistic or structural elements of nature, but then there are other writers who, through a certain knowledge of that or learning of that, impart a certain awe about the world around you, that it's not complete, and that there is, that human knowledge hasn't closed the door on it.
And I think a sad day when it does. You know, I think that that closure, in those terms, you know, with the human mind fully comprehends something, this is a disaster. You know, it's like the lion laying down with a lamb or something. It just not a good idea.
That was Barry Holston Lopez discussing the art of writing. He is the author of Wolves and Men and Winter Count, and the short selection from his book River Notes, which he read, is from an album he produced in collaboration with the cellist David Darling, also entitled River Notes. And now for A Movable Feast.
Local broadcast of A Movable Feast was made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located in the Northgate Square.
A Movable Feast. Hi, I'm Tom Vitale. On this program, Kathy Acker reads from her novel, Blood and Guts in High School. Since the mid-1970s, Kathy Acker has been publishing novels and stories through underground presses in the United States and England. Now a major house, Grove Press, is reissuing several volumes of her fiction, including the novels Great Expectation and Blood and Guts in High School. Kathy Acker was born in New York to wealthy parents in 1947. She studied classic literature at Brandeis, the University of California at San Diego, and the City College of New York. As a young woman, Kathy Acker's family disowned her, and to survive, she worked at a variety of offbeat locations, from bakeries to sex shows. In the 1970s, she was involved in the New York punk cultural movement. Her novel, Blood and Guts, grew out of that experience. And now, reading from that book, Kathy Acker.
Janie becomes a woman. The slums of New York City. A racially mixed group of people live in these slums. Welfare and lower middle class Puerto Ricans, mainly families. A few white students. A few white artists who haven't made it and are still struggling. And those semi-artists who, due to their professions, will never make it. Poets and musicians. Black and white musicians who are into all kinds of music, mainly jazz and punk rock. In the nicer parts of the slums, Ukrainian and Polish families. Down by the river that borders on the eastern edge of these slums, Chinese and middle-class Puerto Rican families. Avenues of junkies, pimps, and hookers form the northern border. The southern border drifts off into even poorer sections, sections too burnt out to be anything but war zones. And the western border is the avenue of bums. A three-room apartment, a 14-by-9-foot room, 2 7-by-9 rooms, and one more 14-by-9 room which contains toilet, bathtub, and stove. Usually no hot water or heat. Costs $200 a month. A few years ago. Many of the people who live in these neighborhoods are too poor to pay their rents. One of the landlords burnt down his building so he could collect the insurance money. Two families and one pimp were sleeping in this building when it burnt down. The landlord sold the charred lot for lots of money to McDonald's, a multinational fast food concern. This is how poor people become transformed into hamburger meat. The slum where Janie chooses to live. The East Village stinks. Garbage covers every inch of the streets. All of the buildings are either burnt down, half burnt down, or falling down. None of the landlords who own the slum live in their disgusting buildings. In the winter, when the temperature averages 0 degrees, these buildings have no hot water or heat. And in the summer at 100 degrees average, Roaches and rats cover the inside walls and ceilings. Only one hospital serves these people, a hospital which dares to exist a few blocks from the northern border of this slum. The hospital contains lights, needles, drugs which cause brain disturbances, utensils, and almost no beds. Whenever there's a holiday, for instance, when Con Ed breaks down, or when a landlord burns down one of his buildings to collect the insurance money, the poor people loot this hospital to amuse themselves. The only supermarket in this neighborhood buys the rotting food the other supermarkets in the city are unable to sell, and sells this food at double price. The local police station contains men who, unlike the people in the market, want nothing to do with the neighborhood. They're scared of the dangerous streets, the alleyways, and they're paid to be scared. There are no out-front local crime coalitions, because the crime bosses don't consider themselves part of the neighborhood. These gangsters who run the city have taken a building, no one knows which building it is, in the northern part of the slum. They have torn out its center, and behind the rat-infested plaster walls that look like the walls of Chinese laundries, behind closed pet stores, antique furniture stores, tenements, within steel walls, within standard CIA protection systems, built a palace. The poor people don't know if this palace exists. They know there's one expensive Italian restaurant in the neighborhood which is always empty, and two espresso joints where the cops sit around and talk to men who wear big guns. The mysterious Mr. Linker. Most of all, Mr. Linker told some of his young hoodlums, I admire healthy young people. You can buy anything but health. If a person isn't healthy, even if he is very rich and famous, he has nothing. Mr. Linker was very fond of teaching. A healthy body and a healthy mind. There is nothing more beautiful than a voluptuous, healthy young girl. When I see a beautiful young girl, when I see someone who is young and voluptuous walking with a man who isn't her equal, you know what I'm talking about, a man who wears glasses or is deformed, I tell you, it disgusts me. I think such people ought to be shot. Yeah, one of his hoodlums mumbled. A healthy body and a healthy mind. He returned to what he had been saying. You probably can't understand this. That was a saying of the Athenian state, the first great state in history. All of our culture comes from ancient Greece. Did you know that? What makes a healthy state? He asked his boys. The hoodlums didn't say anything. It will surprise you. Disease and mental instability cause health. The men who have taken the most extreme risks, who have done what may have disgusted other people or what other people have condemned, are the men who have advanced our civilization. Mr. Linker had seen evidence of disease and mental instability before he was able to speak. Born on the Iranian streets, poverty had made him envy all those who had money. He had to do anything to get money. Poverty is bad for humans because it makes them perpetuate all that is oppressing them, and good for humans because it helps them to be willing to do anything, the weirdest acts possible, suicidal, to stop the poverty. Mr. Linker, having been a beggar's child, saw how society worked. He made himself clever and relentless, relentlessly determined to get rich. If he had remained poverty-stricken, he might have turned this glimmering of intelligence on himself and become a saint. As it turned out, Allah be praised. At age 7, he escaped with a traveling magician, stopped off in Vienna, and at 15 years of age, talked his way into the university to study with Carl Jung. His cleverness and his interest in the mechanics of human social behavior led him into the new science, philosophy of psychology, then into neurology, for he was above all a materialist. And so, Mr. Linker became a lobotomist. In his later life, his cleverness, which he called intelligence, grew to enormous proportions. The more people turned to him for help, and the more he indulged in his own eccentricities, the more he believed he was God. By his middle age, there was no longer any chance he could ever be intelligent, that is, adaptable. He had become a real image, a fake. "The only thing we have," Mr. Linker continued telling his hoodlums, "which separates us from the beasts is culture. Culture is our highest form of life. And it is literature, more than any other art, which enables us to grasp this higher life. For literature is the most abstract of the arts. It is the only art which is not sensual. You know, most people do not read. These days they read only trash. They do not see. They do not appreciate nature. They do not have the artist's eye, and they know nothing. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. Shakespeare said that in Hamlet. He said we are nothing without our culture. Where, then, does our culture come from? I'll tell you. It comes from disease. All the great artists, Goethe, Schiller, and Jean-Paul Sartre, you must read Nausea in the French. In English it is nothing. I have said this. They are aware how evil they are. They are aware this life is truly evil. Due to this awareness, they are able to go beyond. You know that medically, I'm a doctor, a body cannot live without disease. Mr. Linker gave an example of his own disease. Isn't this rug beautiful, he said. I'll tell you the story of this rug. It's not an agreeable story. My wife worked on this rug for 5 years. Tiny birds, silver and white and pale blue, clustered around bunches of grapes in the pale gray moon. Every day she stitched. Mr. Linker had married a young upper-middle-class Viennese girl and brought her to the United States. He bought a resort in the Catskills, his first resort, and she cooked, cleaned, scrubbed, vacuumed, kept the accounts, washed, nursed the hotel guests, and waited on her husband. Soon her eyes began to fail her. She kept on making the rug. She began to have trouble breathing. One day she could no longer stand, and she could no longer do the housework. The doctor told me she was very sick, and she would have to stop working on the rug because the wool was affecting her lungs. I don't understand exactly how. While she was coughing up blood, she kept on working on this rug. The very moment she died, it was in her hand. Actually, Mr. Linker's wife had been driven crazy and then locked up for life in a New York State sanatorium. After Mr. Linker's wife landed in the sanatorium, he added the white slavery business to his lobotomy and summer resort operations. He didn't need the money. At age 75, he was a very wealthy man. He wanted to be able to indulge in his other peculiarities. He was very powerful and intelligent. Hello. My name is Erica Jong. All of you like my novel, Fear of Flying, because in it you met real people. People who loved and suffered and lived. My novel contained real people. That's why you liked it. My new novel, How to Die Successfully, contains those same characters. And it contains two new characters, you and me. All of us are real. Goodbye. Hello. My name is Erica Jong. I'm a real novelist. I write books that talk to you about the agony of American life, how we all suffer, the growing pain that more and more of us are going to feel. Life in this country is going to get more horrible, unbearable, making us maniacs, because mania and death will be the only doors out of prison except for those few rich people, and even they are agonized prisoners in their masks. The paths, the ways they have to act to remain who they are. You think booze, sex, coke, rich food, etc. are doors out? Temporary oblivion at best. We need total oblivion. What was I saying? Yeah. My name is Erica Jong. I would rather be a baby than have sex. I would rather go goo goo. I would rather write goo goo. I'm not catering to you anymore. I'm getting out. I'm ripping up my clothes. I'm ripping up my skin. I hurt. Pain. Hurt me. Pain at this point is good. Do you understand? Pain at this point is good. Me. Feeling. Erica Jong. We. Woo. Woo. I am Erica Jong. I am Erica Jong. You're leaving me without sex. I've gotten hooked on sex, and now I'm... My name is Erica Jong. If there is God, God is disjunction and madness. Yours truly, Erica Jong. This is a poem that Janie wrote for the white slave trader, Mr. Linker, because having nothing else to do, being locked up in the room, she decided she was in love with him. It's her memory of all the Latin poems of Propertius she was forced to translate when she went to school. The deceased. I want all of you out there to shut up. I'm going to live the ways we want to live. What do you want of me now? Liver? Blood? Guts? The only thing left is madness. You too, are you going to drive yourself to the pits? You're going to walk on coals through blazing fires. You're going to drink down the world's most painful poison. That's what wanting love is. My man, he isn't like other men. He can keep you in prison. He can make you do anything. I know why all of you want him. But worse, what happens if my slave trader, for some stupid reason, happens to like you? Then you're screwed. No more sleep. Nor will he let you keep your eyes. He compulsions alone can fetter forces wildness. How many times a spineless being you'll run to all the weaky friends you formerly despised. Tremulous sorrow will arise with tears shuddering. Warts and pimples and fleas will appear on your skin. All your wishes will go. Words are no more. You'll never again know who you are. You'll learn to serve him, girl. To be whatever he wants. To disappear whenever he wants you to go. You'll learn why people who want to die. Why the whole world are lies. Your rich parents ain't helping. 'Cause love's more powerful than social climbing. But if even small, you have given footsteps of your failure, how quickly from such a reputation you will be a murmur. Not I, then I will be able comfort to bear to asking you. 'Cause I'm sick too. At this point, sicker than you. My disease is forever. I know no comfort. Since we're both maniacs, let's be nice to each other. I myself want to live. I want to burn. All I ask is no one loves me in return. Finally, a little song. Blood and guts in high school, this is all I know. Parents, teachers, boyfriends, all have got to go. Some folks like trains, some folks like ships. But I like the way you move your hips. All I want is a taste of your lips, boy. All I want is a taste of your lips.
How do you choose your subject matter? I mean, you've got in Blood and Guts in high school, it's the narrative that the bare plot outline is sort of depressing, and it covers the entire negative cycle of things that can happen to people. It's rape and horrible jobs and living in horrible conditions and abortions and cancer and white slave trading and death.
Well, in a way, Blood and Guts is a bit of a series of bad jokes. It was written when I was in my punk days, 76. But for me, it wasn't so much a choice of subject matter the way most novelists choose a certain character, and this is the life, and the life's going to express a certain viewpoint of the world. It was more taking things that have already been written, taking the society as a series of texts. So taking those actual texts. I mean, the novel is basically plagiarized. And using re-additions, new additions, new renderings of the texts to attack the society. First of all, to find out how it works and then to attack it. And that whatever plot that comes up from that, I mean, in a way, the plot of Blood and Guts in high school isn't a plot. It's the Janie meets a guy, the guy messes her up. That's the plot, only it happens again and again and again and nothing else ever happens. And the nihilism is probably expressive of my life at that point. I don't think I ever hit that kind of nihilism again. But I wasn't doing it to express nihilism. I was doing it to attack a certain culture which seemed to me to be very closely intertied with a certain kind of politics.
And have you stopped in your writing now attacking that culture and those politics?
The anger has changed. I mean, in a way, yes, or the attacks become quite different. It's become much more complex. I mean, to me, Blood and Guts is a bit simplistic. The anger is of a young person, and, you know, it's been many years since I've written the book. And now, you know, the way language and politics is used, the idea of image, you know, language is image, you know, how image is used in various media, is a more complex issue, or I hope I'm dealing with it more complexly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, Blood and Guts in a way was a beginning, but it's reformed itself.
And how about the style of the narrative? I mean, this cut-up style with all sorts of things thrown in. I mean, you know, different. It breaks into poems and play-like dialogue and those pictures, the illustrations.
Well, I guess I believe if writing is anything, it's pleasure. I haven't been saying this, but it is my greatest pleasure. And to have to remember, you know, who a character is or what the action is, or to have to know what you're going to write before you write it, to me is the opposite of pleasure. Plus, I don't live in a world anyway, and I don't think this is a world in which we have the given Aristotelian verites or 19th century verites of, you know, stability. Even of the kind of time-space stability that is Newtonian. And I don't write that way. I don't remember. You know, I do what I want from day to day and figure it all go together. And it's not cut up the way Burroughs cut up, which was to destroy a certain meaning. It's more just the way I perceive.
Certainly, if you haven't lived the lifestyle that's reflected in Blood and Guts, you've observed it. And so you've been on the scene there. And there's always that contradiction with writers, I mean, between living and writing, because if you're writing,
yes,
the experience is sitting down by yourself someplace with your thoughts and putting them on paper, and you can't be leading a fast life.
Right.
So how did you balance the two, or was it different when you were in your so-called punk days?
Well, no. I pretty much live the same way. I write for half the day, and I'm outside for the other half of the day. That is, either I write all during the afternoon, I'm outside at night, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I've gotten older, I'm outside in different ways. But that's how I do it. I think it is pretty strange to sit in a room by yourself and do this stuff. I mean, I think it's really strange. I think most novelists are of a certain personality type.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just go nuts and have to get outside. I used to just, like, go nuts and for 3 days just go outside, and that was it. And, you know, when I got back home, I got back home. But now I'm older. I get back home more regularly. Mm-hmm.
You talked about politics a little bit. I mean, I assume that you have strong political feelings and you do write out of an anger or you want to change things, right?
I guess so. I mean, it'd be hard for me to use those traditional words, you know, left or right. Or the idea of wanting to change things implies an elitism. It's just not that simple for me. But I never thought that my work had any relation to the culture as a whole. That is, I could do what I want politically. I could attack this. I could do that. But no one was listening. No one cared. You know, it was between me mm-hmm. and my friends. And then suddenly I got to England and people were listening and did matter. And they started saying, why'd you do that? What do you think? And at first it was shocking because I had never thought in that way. I was more like a little nasty kid who was having lots of fun. And suddenly I couldn't quite be a nasty kid anymore because I was called to account for all of it. And just the idea that people were listening, that maybe I wasn't so apart from the big culture, gave me the scope to examine materials that I never would have. I've gotten away somewhat from that sort of... I was too wound up in my own interior psychology in some sort of way in, you know, the earlier books, and now I'm able to use more direct political material. A lot of the new book has to do with Kissinger. It has to do with... early American history, trying to see what the notion of freedom was. That's what I'm working on now. I never could have done that earlier if I hadn't had the feeling that I was part of the world in the way that I never felt before.
You've been described variously as a feminist Hubert Selby for the 1980s, Patti Smith of the post-punk prose, and the new Henry Miller. Do you think that you fall into any of those traditions?
What do I think I'm like? I think I'm basically a painter who uses words and pretty influenced by a lot of kind of political semiotic theory. And I like rock and roll.
Maybe we could just talk a minute.
I mean, I could go down and say, no, well, I mean, Patty, I don't think my writing has anything to do with Patty's. Henry Miller, sure, we both use sex. I mean, people always get on this one thing, you know, use sex, he uses sex, therefore. Sure, yeah, I use a lot of sexual material. I mean, you know, but there's nothing else to say beyond that. I mean, there are plenty of writers who've used sexual material. It was more like Gautier or, you know, a lot of pornographers I've admired greatly. De Sade. I mean, I've taken immense amounts from De Sade. Much more than from Henry Miller. Well, the sex, it's a lot of things. I mean, it's a ground, certainly. And when you write sexual material, I mean, direct, you know, I hate the word pornographic in this, but direct orgasmic material.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like pure writing, right? It's really rhythm. You've got to get those rhythms exact. And it's also a way of, you know, that you know that there's a direct connection between you and the reader. And if you mix that kind of really hot connection next to political material, you're doing a very violent number. And that's interesting. But sex is also a way, it's a little like Jean Genet's Slaves. It's also a way of looking up from the bottom to see society in a different way. And also the sexual material of society is very revealing. So for all these reasons, there's a lot of sexual material.
Author Kathy Acker. Her novel Blood and Guts in High School is published by Grove Press. For a list of Movable Feast programs available on cassette, write to In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York, New York, 10113. Again, our address is In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York City, 10113. Funds for this program are provided in part by the Witter-Binner Foundation for Poetry and by the Academy of American Poets. Theme music by The Minx, the mixing engineer Gary Fink. With contemporary literature on a movable feast, I'm Tom Vitale.
Local broadcast of A Movable Feast was made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located in the Northgate Square.